Welcome to the Eurointelligence podcast. I'm Wolfgang Munschau, and with me are Susanne Munschenk and Jack Smith. Today we're going to talk about treaty change and NATO membership. Susanne, you covered the story of Macron's perhaps surprising speech at the beginning of the week, surprising in the sense that very few journalists were briefed, when he made a rather ambitious proposal about the future of the EU. Do you think this has legs?
Well, we at Eurointelligence, we looked at these proposals and said, well, with sort of a mixture of excitement and concern. Excitement because he's the first big country European leader who comes up with this idea after decades of denying that. It's sort of this role of a political community and being all drawn down into the rule of law debates. And here he comes, Emmanuel Macron in Strasbourg, evokes this kind of political community, a community for European countries, to be clear, in either accession status or not even, we don't know yet, but definitely the ones who are about to be candidates for the EU, to offer them a perspective, to have a sort of a way of engaging with them on political and security matters. And obviously that's sort of a hand reaching out to Ukraine. He was mentioning that we all know that these accession negotiations, they take ages. It's a technical thing. They have to go through various chapters. And even if Ukraine fulfills 70% of the association regulations, it's the last bit of these things that they might find very difficult, especially if the war draws on, to show that you're a robust economy and have all the security issues in place, the rule of law things in place, that will be very tricky for them. So to offer them a perspective where the Europeans are coming together with candidate countries and everyone who's wanting to join, that also actually extends to the UK who left the EU but still might want to join this kind of political community, whatever that is. At the moment, it is an idea out there which we don't know what direction it will take. It's so vague that everyone can project their own kind of idea, what it means. What it doesn't mean is, I think, what some, like the Ukrainian ambassador in Berlin was mentioning, that it is a replacement for membership. That is not how we understood it. Our understanding is that it was meant to really be a sort of in parallel, to just to capture all the frustrations that come up with these processes. We've seen what had happened in Turkey. Very much of a started on enthusiasm and then it pattered away throughout the years and years of negotiation.
And there's no reason why it can't be both. If you create an associate membership status, a formal one, not just having these individual agreements as we do have, actually, we actually have one with Ukraine, but if you create sort of an EU associate member status for countries, that can both be a permanent and as well as an anteroom for membership, for depending on the country. There may be countries, it may be, you know, there may be at some point of the very distant future, a UK government that's open to this kind of thing, but it may not be open to membership. So it would be a possibility for the EU and the UK to develop a closer relationship that is not based on this, you know, very unequal, you know, thing that's given rise to so many disputes as the TCA has done. But it could also be for other member states as a way to become full members.
Yeah, I definitely think there's something in the idea of associate membership for countries that want to eventually accede to the EU, but will take a while to do so. Maybe kind of systematizing that process a little bit more and bringing more kind of political and social benefits to those member states to compensate for the sheer amount of time that accession now takes. I'm a little bit less sold on it when it comes to former member states or countries that realistically don't want to become full EU member states. Because, you know, if you look at, say, the UK, Norway, Switzerland, the big countries that have some level of agreement with the EU on some things, but do not want to become full member states, they usually have very specific reasons for not wanting to do so. And therefore, they tend to want more bespoke arrangements with the EU. For instance, I think from a political point of view, I find it very difficult to believe that Switzerland would ever really want to replace the kind of naughty bilateral relationship that it has with the EU, like the series of agreements, with anything that was comparable to the way another country deals with the EU.
But the point is the EU wants to change it.
Yeah, the point is the EU wants to change it. I just think that they're going to find it difficult to find a place where they can cooperate fruitfully with these countries, but also put them in the same kind of like associate members bucket.
Yeah, I would think that associate members status, if something like this happened. I mean, the question is, the UK is neither in the single market nor in the customs union. Norway is not in the customs union, but it is in the single market. And Turkey is in the customs union, but not the single market. So we're already having these massive you know, divisions of these various relationships the EU has with member states. So the question is, what is an associate membership? Single market and customs unions are by far the most important things the EU has ever done. So in terms of those two categories, what is the relationship? Is this both in, or is it just the customs union in? I would assume the customs union would have to be a prerequisite. I don't think it would make sense without a customs union, because also in our history, the customs union preceded the single market. The fact that it's upside down in Norway, some very specific reasons that are oil industry specific and stuff like that, and
fishing.
There are various, you know, domestic policy reasons, and there may be derogations. My experience with the EU is, if we can, you know, point to a technical argument like that, there may well be solutions to handling this, and that there may well be, you know, a multi-layered associate membership status. But the bottom line is that the EU can't move ahead at the basis of 27, 30, 35 member states. It needs a form of variable geometry for those that want to do more, to actually be able to do more. And, you know, as we in Eurointelligence have been focusing on for many years now, is the euro area, the eurozone, which is really a dysfunctional monetary union, because it has a very well functioning central bank, but a complete absent fiscal coordination mechanism. So we get things like the fiscal and monetary policy mix all wrong pretty much at all times. We get fiscal coordination wrong between member states. It's dysfunctional. And, you know, it can't be right that a country like Denmark or Sweden holds us back.
Yeah. You wrote the thing about, we don't know really what this whole political union is about and what sort of objectives is. I think it's really too early to speculate about the entry requirements, because we don't even know what the target or what the goal is from that. What is the objective of this political unity? And I think until we have to find that first, yeah, that's the first thing to do. I mean, one of the conditions you mentioned, Wolfgang, in your article this week is actually how it is linked to QME and to qualified majority voting. And then this puts us square into the field of treaty change and treaty revisions. Can you tell us a bit more?
I mean, QMV was the big sort of progress the EU has made over treaty changes in the past. The Lisbon Treaty in particular increased the QMV scope for QMV. It used to be, many years ago, it used to be only the single market QMV, but it's now, you know, QMV is now the normal procedure. And unanimity is now, it's kind of upside down, but it's unanimity still exists for things like foreign policy. It exists for agreement on the budget, for many, many important issues. Unanimity is important. We have this instrument of sort of inverse QMV, where the Commission decides and the proposal has to be blocked by a qualified majority as opposed to be approved by a qualified majority. So you have layers on different levels on which minority and small country interests can be protected. I think QMV is a good system. It protects both the, you know, one person, one vote principle, but it also respects the fact that we are a union of countries, and not all countries are the same size. We have seen this in the United States. The Senate has two members from each state. It's got 50 states, exactly 100 members. So New York is nominally underrepresented. And, you know, states like Delaware and Idaho would be massively overrepresented with their two senators. But it doesn't matter. The system worked very well. In the UK, you have the House of Lords, not exactly a beacon of modern democracy. It works because it's a revising chamber. It's actually, you know, a system, whatever one thinks about it, it doesn't render democracy absurd, because it's the same that successfully managed to restrain itself. It doesn't use the powers that it nominally has, but it makes useful notations to laws and makes sure that laws improve in quality. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I don't have strong views on these matters. So I think QMV is as good a voting system as any. So the question is, do we we want to continue? Do we actually want to extend it further? And that requires treaty change. This is not something we can simply do. We could, in theory, use, and we discussed a proposal by Andrew Duff, former MEP, who proposed to use the existing passerelle clause, which is passerelle is French for bridge. And it exists. It's a bit like enhanced cooperation is another sort of one of these ghost concepts that the EU has created and never really used. Enhanced cooperation was used only on a very small number of occasions, but it's not been what we thought and hoped it would be. The same with the passerelle clause, which has been around for 20 years, but it hasn't been used at all. And the passerelle clause allows the Council, the European Council, to bridge into areas that are currently not subject to QMV, and to declare them to become subject of QMV, but they need to do so with unanimity, and that has never happened. Because obviously the whole idea is if we all agree to do something by QMV, we can obviously use the passerelle clause. We can also agree to change the treaty. Once we have that degree of unanimity, we can do a small treaty change. So ultimately, it's not that big of a deal. The fact that it hasn't been used is not so much the fact that the instrument is awkward. The fact it tells you how little consensus we have. And if you also remember the foreign policy of Angela Merkel during that period, her proximity of that administration to Russia has led many East European countries to insist that they want to actually have a veto, because with the QMV, Germany and France, and the pro-Russian majority back then, the pro kind of Russian relations majority in the EU, might have just pushed through a number of foreign policy decisions that would have violated the vital interests of some of the smaller member states of East Europe, especially the Baltic states. So these are subtle questions that need to be answered. QMV means you can get outvoted, and that means you've got to have a certain readiness for that. The Germans always say, yes, we are in favor of that. But what happens if the EU's foreign policy is no longer support, Germany's new mercantilist policies, and people will then scream murder and they will say, look, I mean, this is not what we had intended. We had intended to have it both ways, no? To have QMV. But, we want to be the majority. We don't want to be the minority. We don't want to be outvoted. And that is possible under QMV for Germany to be outvoted. And it does actually happen.
Yeah, and of course, it's much easier for a big country to say that they're all in favor of moving towards a more QMV-based system because, if you account for almost 20% of the EU's population by yourself, realistically speaking, you just need to find, a few more kind of medium-sized countries and then you've got a blocking minority. Obviously, if you're like Latvia, you're going to have far more concern about ending unanimity.
Hmm. How does this, the war in Ukraine and... how actually Russia managed to unite a lot of the European countries in a way that didn't happen before. That seems to be changing also probably the likelihood of QMV to be possible in this respect. The second question to you, Wolfgang, was how is it linked to the idea of a political community as suggested by Macron? Macron is in favor of extending QMV to the whole to all policy areas, as has been the result from 1 year of work of the Future of Europe consultations. And now the European Parliament is pushing for a convention on treaty change where these issues would come up. But sort of just to understand, we don't know what this political community is like, but without QMV, probably it would be nothing but a debating club. But with QMV, could it have a little bit more bite?
I mean, voting systems matter. They don't matter as much as politicians think, but they do matter. We've seen this, I remember in Italy, they've been every 5 to 10 years, they're discussing a new electoral system. There's a complete obsession in Italy with electoral systems. And generally that is unjustified because the people who propose these changes tend to lose out themselves after their preferred voting system comes in because the system adjusts. This is the same debate you have in the United States about the electoral college. You could say that Trump would not have won under one person, one vote system, but then again, he would have run a different campaign. He might have won. It's just in the end, you don't know the impact of voting system, and people do. There's an awful lot of talk, especially in the United States, about gerrymandering, about redrawing of districts and stuff. In the end, I have doubts that it matters so much. But yes, I would think that the step from unanimity to QMV that does matter. that would increase, that would change the dynamics of foreign policy. My broad objections to this process is this: the EU has sort of started integration, like monetary integration, but then not completed it. There are big gaps. It's not only the fact that we don't have a common Eurobond and a fiscal union, but we also didn't even make progress on the banking union, because beyond the first very insufficient steps, almost no progress on capital markets union. These things, boring as though they may sound, and it's not some of the stuff that excites the policy folk who talk about QMV and who are in the conference on the future of Europe and, you know, at the level of Macron and the European Council. You know, they don't like to talk about these things, but they will matter for the EU and for the cohesion of the EU in the long run more, just as the single market and the customs union matter. You know, got the EU to where it is. This was, you know, this is how we started. It started up with something relatively technical, but now we are, you know, we're doing foreign policy and, you know, we're not all that successful. I mean, we keep writing on these stories about ruble payments. Here's the Commission, you know, saying you can't pay in rubles. Here are the member states that pay now in rubles. Essentially, we're all paying in rubles. Here's the Commission saying, you know, we're going to put all the Russian banks on the, you know, ban them from SWIFT, and then the member states come up and draw sort of long lists of examples. So in the end, this is not a very effective way of operating. And there is a sense of, you know, attention deficit syndrome sort of creeping into the system of European integration, where we just continue, do new areas, but do a lot of things badly then rather than a few things well.
Yeah, I think, too, on that kind of point about things like the banking union and capital markets union, a lot of the time, in my opinion, at least, these issues come to kind of lack salience precisely because of the way the voting system encourages them to fragment into a bunch of different smaller initiatives. You know, so one thing I wrote about recently was kind of DEBRA and the whole old chestnut about a common corporate tax in the EU, where it's kind of, you can see that taking place because you needed unanimity to change the tax rules. Something that was highly salient, which is a common corporate tax, is now getting kind of, you know, gradually like split up into more abstruse and less understandable chunks, which ultimately impedes its progress because it's just not something that you can communicate very successfully.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you had QMV on taxation, which we don't, then we would have had a common corporate tax base a long time ago.
Mm. Yeah. Definitely.
No, that's another area where QMV would make a difference. And the reason why we are fragmenting this, we had a similar debate on the European patent that just took forever. And that concluded with actually successfully. And this was one of the few areas where enhanced cooperation did work. But in general, you know, I'm not saying these voting systems don't matter. They do. They will get us further. But it's an important a question of whether we should sort of focus so much on it.
I mean, the question is, now we talked about the internals from the EU perspective, but what would be the prospect of candidate countries? What would be the interest to join a political community from the Ukraine perspective, but also maybe from others, Turkey? Would there be an interest to join an extra political community?
I can see that. Point of the Ukrainian ambassador to Berlin, that, I mean, he smells a rat here very clearly. He doesn't believe anything he's been told. And, you know, frankly, being the Ukrainian ambassador in Berlin after what he's gone through, I wouldn't probably believe anything I'm told either, given that they have told him so many things and they're not delivered, like the, you know, Olaf Scholz's permanent U-turns on whether or not he's in favor of weapon sales. So the idea that the EU says something, makes a proposal that could be sold as a step one to membership, but it might ultimately be frustrated, an institutional framework that allows them to frustrate it. So I can see that they would like to have at least clarification on this.
But, I mean, you don't need an extra gremium for that. I mean, look at Turkey and others. It's no problem just to death by technocratic procedures. Yes. I mean, that's already possible. So I don't think that there is need of an extra institution to make that point.
Yeah, I was going to say two things. The first thing on Turkey is, I think it was a combination of two things, right? One of them was that kind of on a more informal basis, it became obvious to Turkey and to everybody else that numerous member states were just never going to sign off on Turkish membership. That then kind of created a lack of willingness to move forward on the kind of actual, you know, kind of dossiers that they needed to move forward on. Mm-hmm. And so then that gives you a legitimate reason to kind of continually, like, yeah, you know, slow walk their candidacy. The second thing on associate membership is, I mean, there are, of course, other problems that this raises. But one option which I think could maybe have some legs is giving associate members more single market access than the candidacy process currently involves, but doing it on a kind of more time limited and supervised basis. You know, one of the obvious problems with admitting countries into the EU is that there's no simple way to kind of basically sanction them or penalize them or materially restrict their access if they start systematically breaking the rules. Having something that is a bit more kind of safeguarded but also gives you more access might be a way to convince these countries to kind of sign on, because they'll actually get some more tangible benefits of association while also protecting the interests of the EU at large.
Yeah, this could, for example, one could use the UK Trade and Cooperation Agreement, which has sunset clauses for certain mutual recognition of regulation and these things. They could become kind of a blueprint that you basically say, okay, you are in the single market for financial services, the financial services area. We're going to give you 3 years of membership of that, and then we'll be making an evaluation at the end of that. That's obviously not possible once you're already in the single market and you're in.
Yeah, or, you know, free movement, you can kind of introduce another category where you say, okay, you have maybe like a time limited right to work or a certain kind of, you know, temporary work permit that you can apply for, as opposed to permanent and total freedom of movement. You know, I thought another model would be like kind of the relationship that the EU has with Switzerland, where the treaties come up for renegotiation on a periodic basis. Of course, it's a royal pain, but that's also partly because the whole thing has been done in a very typically Swiss way, where everything is broken into a separate treaty. Yeah. That's something you could hopefully avoid under a single associate membership umbrella.
I mean, I just throw in another way of reading or interpreting what Emmanuel Macron was suggesting. You could also read it as a way of engaging countries like Ukraine in the future design of a security strategy for Europe. I mean, that links actually to the second subject, NATO and the role of Europe. So if we are talking about an infrastructure, a security infrastructure that is to change, and de facto it is already changing, we have a couple of countries, Sweden and Finland, about to formally apply for NATO membership. So two neutral countries less in Europe. We still have Austria. We still have Ireland and Malta. So three neutral countries. The rest is in NATO. The US, at the moment, they're still happy with going along that way, but for how long? There's clearly a desire to define something European, structural security agenda. And you could say, well, this political or security community, it could be about the future, about something that is not there yet, rather than talking about something that is already there and where it's all about QMV. Why don't we think about a community that is really about engaging them early on in a design? And there actually we could use, Ukraine has its place. It already has its place because it changed everything in terms of security, the defense for the Europeans. It would make sense then to say, let's think about these structures, infrastructures together.
Yeah, on this kind of point about what the US does, I'm always kind of a bit skeptical of suggestions that the US will eventually try to kind of pull away more from Europe in the context of NATO, because the American kind of vision of a more autonomous Europe and security is one where the European countries spend more on defense, but they continue buying American-made weapon systems. I don't really see how those two things are kind of compatible, where, you know, inevitably the US is kind of pulled back quite a bit every time it's become clear that more European strategic autonomy would mean the European, you know, European weapons manufacturers and defense companies displacing American ones, because then at some point it becomes about kind of interests, lobbying, X number of jobs in, I don't know, whichever random town in West Virginia and so on and so forth. And, you know, the kind of inner wheels of pork barrel spending in American politics start to turn against it.
Yeah. Is it thinkable that the EU and might develop structures now with Finland and Sweden inside, that there may be a more formal role of the EU inside NATO?
I think personally that would be a bit difficult, so long as you continue to have countries that are constitutionally committed to neutrality within the EU, right? Mm. You know, the Austrian constitution is unequivocal that the country cannot enter into a military alliance of any sort, right? Any kind of moves in that direction could cause various very serious legal problems for Austria's continued EU membership.
For Ireland too. I mean, Ireland had this advantage. I mean, the history of why neutrality came about is very different than the ones who actually share a border with Russia and are coming from the former Soviet Union. So Ireland has its own story of neutrality, and it doesn't necessarily link to the one from Finland, who shares a 1,300 kilometer long border to Russia. It's a totally different game.
Yeah, Ireland's kind of neutrality is also driven by a very strong desire to not be formally dependent on the United Kingdom for its defense and security.
Absolutely.
Of course, the paradox of this is that Ireland has ended up becoming informally dependent on the UK, right? Mm. You know, Ireland's greatest asset from a security point of view is that a nuclear weapons state blocks it off from the rest of Europe.
Mm. But still, I mean, neutrality is something, it's an inspiration, it's about values. It's not necessarily that it has to have a certain shape and form. I mean, Ireland has no problems of NATO flights landing in Shannon Airport. They are open to these things. It's not really like it's set in stone, but it is about having the sovereignty of deciding how does neutrality look like in that particular point in time for a particular situation, where they have to make moral judgments about where do we want to sit. And I think in that sense, for Ireland, it is absolutely crucial to keep that neutrality. And actually, I think personally, I think it's a shame that Finland and Sweden are rushed to give up their long-standing neutrality. Because it has a long-term benefit that even though you can understand that this urge after 100 days of Russian invasion, that there is an urge and an urgency to move towards protection from NATO, we can understand that. But there is a cost to it, and the cost is on the long term. When you lose your status of neutrality, you lose also a certain credibility with the Russia that will not cease to exist even after the war. So a lot of those things and roles that they could have played before, they will no longer be able to play. And even if the threat potential that Russia tried to mock up, even towards Ireland with their assimilation of an attack on Ireland running through Russian TV stations, that definitely scared the Irish. But do we react? Are we always in reaction mode? Is that the neutrality should have a little bit more flesh to it than just that?
Yeah, maybe it's a consolation to Ireland that Russian state TV said they would do far, far, far worse things to the UK. But another point that I just to make on Ireland versus the Nordic countries that are joining NATO is that the internal political conversation on NATO, even going back decades, has been quite different in Sweden and Finland compared to Ireland. You've had major political figures in the kind of main center-right parties in both Sweden and Finland who have advocated for those countries becoming NATO members, you know, so Carl Bildt, who is a former prime minister of Sweden, and Alexander Stubb, who is a former prime minister of Finland, from kind of the center-right moderates and National Coalition Party, respectively, have both been quite openly in favor of those countries becoming NATO members for a long time. In Ireland, however, unless there's something that I've missed out, both of the main system parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, have been kind of, you know, very committed to neutrality. Sinn Féin is definitely committed to neutrality.
Absolutely.
So although the actual timing and pace of this has been very quick, there has been a place for NATO membership in the mainstream political conversation in Sweden and Finland for quite some time. Mm-hmm. In Ireland, that's just not really been the case in this way, I don't think.
So the test will be whether these countries will still have the public support for NATO membership after the war is over, and or whether the public opinion will revert to the status quo ante in favor of neutrality.
I mean, the public opinion captures this urgency, but the reality is that the mindset, everything has to change. I mean, to change the mindset from a neutrality kind of mindset to a multilateral decision-making process. It's a huge shift.
It's a big deal. They might not be prepared for what's to come because NATO membership does require them. I mean, it's not so much on the technical side. I think they're technically prepared, but there is a political.
The freedom is gone.
Engagement that is different.
Yeah. Again, though, they've taken some kind of halfway measures, right? So both Sweden and Finland have been members of the UK-led Joint Expeditionary Force. Now that doesn't involve nearly as many obligations as NATO does, but it's still kind of a step forward in terms of political coordination.
Okay. On that note, I think we would like to wrap it up. Thank you for listening. Until next Friday.